From Vermont Public, this is Brave Little State. I'm Josh Crane. It's election season. In just a few weeks, our country will elect a new president. Vermont will choose U.S. and state senators and representatives, a governor, and many others who will shape Vermont's next chapter. This year, the Brave Little State mothership, Vermont Public, has been trying something different. We've been starting our election coverage not with politicians and pollsters, but with you, the people. It's an approach known as the Citizens' Agenda. And it sounds kind of familiar, right? Brave Little State is Vermont Public's listener-powered journalism show. We choose stories based on your curiosity. But today, instead of focusing on one listener question, we're going big. We've dedicated this whole episode to one of the topics you've mentioned again and again in conversations with Vermont Public reporters about the issues you care most about this election season. Our reporters have spoken to you at general stores, bookstores, libraries, creamy stands, at the dump, and we've also heard from you online. And there was one topic that rose to the top over and over again. Abigail?
Yeah, the thing you told us you want to hear more about this election season is climate change.
Abigail Giles, you report on climate and the environment for Vermont Public, which means you're the perfect person to help us navigate this topic.
I don't know about that, Josh. I mean, climate change is such a huge topic, but it might help if we zoom in a little. And in Vermont, a big reason people are focused on climate change has to do with what is happening right here in this state. Vermont is warming faster on average than the rest of the world. We now see more than 50% more extreme precipitation than we did before 1995. In the last few years, Vermont has experienced 100-year flooding emergencies, multiple years in a row. Some of the most damaging effects of climate change that we've felt firsthand. At least so far. And as is the case all over the world, these effects are felt most by people who work outside, people who live outside, people who are lower income, renters, and people of color.
Okay, so what you're saying is that climate change is basically on Vermont's doorstep. Or maybe even through the front door.
Yes, exactly. And this is all leading to more conversation about what we can do, not only to help people adapt to this new reality, but also to address the root cause of climate change, which is humans burning fossil fuels, including here in Vermont. I hear from a lot of people who wonder what the point is of Vermont curbing its emissions when they make up such a small part of the global emissions pie. And while Vermont's total emissions are tiny compared with the world as a whole, like really tiny, Vermonters actually burn a lot of fossil fuels per capita. The average person here contributes twice as many emissions as the average person does globally.
So there are a lot of different ways to think about our role when it comes to climate change. And how are Vermont lawmakers responding?
Well, in the 2025 session, lawmakers will decide about whether to adopt a first-in-the-nation policy to cut fossil fuel consumption from heating buildings. It's called the Affordable Heat Act. Its supporters say the goal is to speed up the pace of Vermont's transition away from fossil fuels, since right now, some 60% of Vermont households rely on fossil fuels for heat. And there's a lot of money, some of it from outside of Vermont, that's being spent right now to convince people that this policy is a good or a bad idea, and to get lawmakers elected who will support or condemn it.
So it sounds like how all of this goes will depend largely on the results of the upcoming election.
Yeah, I think that's fair. There's a lot at stake here. And this is just one of several climate policies Vermont has advanced in recent years, including the Climate Superfund Act, an update to the Renewable Energy Standard, and a major flood resilience bill.
And when it comes to these policies that lawmakers are creating, how are people you talk to feeling about them?
Well, a lot of people are craving more specifics, and they're wondering, where do they fit in? What can I as one person do? What can I afford? Will this transition be something I can participate in? Will it make life better or harder for me?
Mm-hmm. We can't afford another disaster, and yet they're not going to stop.
How we manage our resources and look after the health of our planet is critical.
We need to find common ground because we don't have time to mess around anymore.
But in terms of the issues, the top thing for me is climate.
While I'm really in favor of green energy, I'm also very aware that it's only green as long as you're not destroying the environment to install it.
If the towns are all destroyed by floods, you have ruined your tax base and economy.
What we don't have is some money to make all this happen.
I am so frustrated that climate issues have become hyper-partisan.
If the house is on fire, it doesn't matter what else is going on inside.
Vermont's energy transition is already here. Fuel sales are going down year over year, and more households in the state have heat pumps. In 2035, you won't be able to purchase a new internal combustion car at a Vermont dealership. So these questions about how much it all costs and who pays, and also who benefits from all this new technology, they're some of the most important questions of our time.
Brave Little State is a production of Vermont Public and a proud member of the NPR network. Welcome.
I had a lot of conversations with people who wrote in for our Citizens Agenda project, the project that's shaped Vermont Public's election coverage this year. But two people in particular stayed with me. The first is Laura.
It just feels like this big, huge, heavy thing that is bearing down on the world.
Laura Zettler lives in Fairfax, and she tells me about an experience that really sums up her feelings about climate change. Actually, it's something that happens right before I speak to her over the phone. She was at a gas pump filling up her car, and she was talking to her 10-year-old son about the interview she's about to do with me.
And when I told him, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to, you know, talk to, you know, about climate change, and I was filling up my car, and he's like, isn't that going to be a little awkward for you, Mom, since you're talking about climate change and you're filling up your, you know, your gas car? And then my husband and I were like, well, it's actually a good point because...
A good point because climate change is already costing Vermont. Nearby Washington County, home to the state capital, is the second most disaster-prone county in the United States. That's if you count the number of federal disaster declarations over the last decade or so. So Laura is seeing all of this, and she's incredibly motivated to do everything she can to help. But when she went to buy a car a few years back, she says an electric vehicle was out of reach financially, even with incentives.
With me having it be like one of my main worries, you know, something that definitely keeps me up at night sometimes, I'm still not even doing as much as I would like. So I feel like I directly do feel the financial barrier.
Laura's sense of guilt magnifies when she thinks about her students. She teaches 7th and 8th grade in St. Albans. She says she talks to her students about climate change a lot.
There's a lot of them that feel like it's hopeless at this point, that there is nothing that can be done at this point. And there's not all of them, obviously, but, you know, a lot of them just kind of feel like, okay, yeah, the world's warming up, like, but whatever, like, this is what's going to happen. And I always tell them, like, that's the scariest thing you can think, because if you think that, then nobody's going to do anything, and then it is going to happen.
We can't keep doing what we're doing, and we certainly shouldn't be making more people struggle along the way, or we just polarize even further. I mean, just look at what's happening going into this election. It makes my hair stand on end. It should make yours.
This is Pam Ladds. Like Laura, Pam is worried about climate change, but she's also worried about affordability and about policymakers in Montpelier not really understanding the needs of people in rural places like Newport and the rest of the Northeast Kingdom. I met Pam at a Vermont Public ice cream social in downtown Newport earlier this fall.
There's not much up here that earns a decent living for people. There's not much. So it's really easy to blow us off up here.
I followed up with her a few weeks later at her home. Pam lives in an old farmhouse, the oldest in town, she tells me.
It's the old stagecoach inn. And it's still standing. It's a great, solid house.
She gives me a tour.
A trip into the basement. don't fall down the stairs.
Pam is on a mission here. There is something she wants to show me.
Mind the cobwebs and duck. You know, ceilings are really low.
She leads me towards a dusty gray metal panel.
This is an electric panel.
An old, outdated electric panel, to be precise. She says it just doesn't make financial sense to upgrade it, which is what she was told she'd need to do if she wanted to get a heat pump, which would be an efficient way to electrify at least some of her heat.
So I will be surprised if it happens in my lifetime, here anyway.
This is why Pam has some concerns about the Affordable Heat Act, the energy policy state lawmakers will decide on this session. Chief among them, will it actually be affordable for everybody?
If I was sitting where you are at the age that you are, and obviously I'm hallucinating your age here, but it's significantly younger than mine, I would be saying to everybody else who has screwed up the climate, and that's my generation, whether we like to admit that or not, come on, you lot, fix it. And we actually don't give a flying whoop-de-doo what it costs you because you did this to us. It's our planet moving forward. So it's not that I don't understand the push to really clean up what's happening, and it needs cleaning up. I think the challenge is how to do it and how to do it in a way that allows the rest of us who are inhabiting the planet to still live and not be homeless on the street, which won't solve anybody's problem.
Okay, so for the most part, what we heard from Vermonters is that climate change, which is largely caused by humans burning carbon, is a big concern for them. But for a lot of people, taking the big steps that will set them up to use less carbon and likely save money long term, like upgrading an electric panel or buying an electric vehicle, they can feel out of reach. And that makes people anxious. Anxious that climate policies will make their lives unaffordable, anxious that they'll get left behind, anxious that they aren't doing all they want to do to leave this place better for their kids. Remember how Laura was feeling guilty that she couldn't afford an electric car? It's the type of thing Sarah Kelly at Dartmouth has heard before.
That's not her fault, and I hope that she doesn't feel too badly about it.
Sarah is a geographer and the co-founder of the Energy Justice Clinic at Dartmouth. She works with communities to study water and energy equity issues. Sarah says she hopes Laura and anyone else who can't afford the upfront cost of a lower carbon alternative, like an electric car or hot water heater, that they don't feel shame or guilt.
I think people can only transition certain aspects of their livelihood within a longer time frame, and not everybody has the financial ability to do it all at once.
Sarah says this transition can be especially challenging in a place like Vermont. And there's actually a name for this.
So there's been research that the Department of Energy and others, the Island Institute in Maine, have done around recognizing that there's a rural efficiency gap.
This rural efficiency gap, it's something I've heard about in so many words reporting in rural places for a long time. It's basically describing a failure of the market, that people in rural places, they're significantly less likely than people in more urban places to be able to use things like electric vehicle incentives or rebates for efficient appliances because of factors like high upfront costs or lack of access. Wages in rural economies also tend to be lower than those in more urban areas. And this means rural residents also spend more on energy compared with their income. And all of this, combined with the fact that the fossil fuel industry willfully concealed the connection between its products and climate change from the public for decades, all of it can lead to distrust and skepticism.
You know, folks are surviving, folks are taking care of their basic needs, and there's a lot of stress involved with needing to choose between paying for your energy bill, paying for your rising housing costs, or other needs.
And speaking of costs, even if weatherizing or switching to a lower carbon heat source costs money up front, it has the potential to bring huge savings for households that spend the biggest share of their income now on fossil fuel heat. But those upfront costs can be tricky. And here's where electoral politics come in again. People who support the Affordable Heat Act hope that policy will help bridge this gap. That's because the law would require companies involved in importing and distributing fossil heating fuels to earn so-called clean heat credits. And a share of these credits would have to come from working with low and moderate income households in Vermont to install things like heat pumps or weatherize their homes or sell them biofuels, among other things. But people who oppose this approach, they worry it will make this rural efficiency gap worse. People, including members of the Public Utility Commission, have argued that Vermont is just too small to pioneer a first-of-its-kind climate solution like this. Others have raised questions about whether Vermont will be able to enforce the rules and whether it will hurt small businesses. To be honest, it's really hard to explain this policy. It's complex, and so many of the details are still uncertain. They're the types of things that elected officials will have to wade through this session. This is just one possible approach to addressing gaps in who benefits from Vermont's energy transition. An important first step for any long-term solution, Sarah Kelly says, is for communities who are most burdened now to get a voice.
Oftentimes, falling behind on your energy bills is a first step to homelessness. And so those are intricately connected, and people working in social work in those fields recognize those connections. So we need more research to understand in our rural communities who's most affected by energy insecurity and how that's intersecting with housing insecurity.
Everybody deserves to benefit from the clean energy transition.
This is Costa Samaras.
And a clean energy transition that doesn't bring everybody along and doesn't have the opportunity for everyone to see themselves in won't be successful in the long term.
Costa is an engineer who was a senior advisor in the Biden White House. He was there when Congress hashed out what is arguably the United States' biggest investment in addressing climate change ever, the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA. Passed by Congress in 2022, it directed nearly $400 billion towards just about every sector of the economy, much of which comes in the form of tax credits to help grease the wheels for the country's energy transition.
I'm very confident that the current policies that are in place, as well as potential future policies, will center that affordability, decarbonized, resilient, and equitable starting point for how we approach energy and climate policy going forward.
Preliminary data shows Americans have used those credits at more than twice the rate that government officials had expected. And on top of that, Vermont got tens of millions of dollars from the IRA to create its own rebates for things like heat pumps, weatherization, and electric panel upgrades. If the feds approve Vermont's plan, the state energy office will funnel that money towards helping low and moderate income households. These will go well beyond what you can access now and could radically expand who has access to new technology. Now, the IRA is not going to get us to our climate commitments alone. It's limited one-time funding. Once this money is used up, Vermont could face a steep revenue cliff. This is a huge reason lawmakers and other policymakers in the state are looking for other ways to fund this kind of work long-term. Hence, the Affordable Heat Act.
We're going to be muddling through climate resilience for the rest of our lives. We're doing it right now.
Something that struck me through my reporting, taking climate action is a little like building a plane while you fly it. There's always risk involved in doing something new. Like, what if you don't build a plane that works very well? Or what if it doesn't serve everybody? But at the same time, there's terrible risk in not doing anything at all.
Of course things are going to fail. Of course we're going to do the wrong thing. We have to keep doing better.
Continuing to do better when we come back. When it comes to climate change, some Vermont policymakers are focusing on mitigation. That is, cutting greenhouse gas emissions to try and minimize the impact of climate change in the future. That's the main focus of the Affordable Heat Act, for instance. At the same time, Vermont is also trying to adapt to the consequences of climate change as we're experiencing those consequences, like rebuilding after destructive flooding events. Only at times, it feels like we're constantly playing catch up.
Something that is happening across the country and also in New England and in Vermont is that we're hearing after a flood, well, you know, I moved away from the river or moved away from the shoreline, and now I'm getting flooded. Why is that?
Andrew Kruchkovich is a meteorologist at Columbia University's Climate School who studies extreme weather. And he says Vermont is not alone in seeing more flooding and extreme rain because of climate change.
And there's reasons for that. I mean, one of the closest connections in terms of extreme weather now and climate change is as the atmosphere warms, the capacity for the atmosphere to hold more water vapor increases. And that translates into increased risk for intense rainfall episodes.
And the science says that pace will only accelerate if we keep doing what we've been doing, which is why Andrew says mitigation, again, that's cutting emissions, is so important too. It's why figuring out the right balance between adaptation and mitigation is so important. Climate change and climate-fueled disasters are already exacerbating the disparities that have long existed in Vermont, around class and race and economic opportunity, around who gets to live here and feel safe.
The question that we must ask, even more than we do now, is to what extent are we sure that the climate adaptation strategies being implemented are not increasing the disproportionality of impact from extreme events when we're referring to the most vulnerable populations?
This question of how to protect people, but also how to move quickly, it feels especially relevant in a place like Barrie City.
Yeah, we are standing along Brook Street, looking out over Gunners Brook, and some of what was left after this July's flooding, some of the debris and things like that, in what had been planned to be a floodplain a number of years ago and did some of its job, but I think we've learned we need to do more.
Amanda Gustin is one of the founders of the grassroots flood recovery group Barrie Up, and she's a city councilor. We're standing by the community garden on Barrie's Brook Street. Just past the brook is a gravelly expanse at the heart of the neighborhood. We're looking at a floodplain that's on its way to being restored.
And you can see those big concrete berms that are intended to be sort of debris and trash catchers to keep debris from barreling down the river even faster.
Less than 10 years ago, this place looked very different. The gravelly expanse was filled with houses and a bridge across the brook. Then, in 2015, those houses were bought by the city and demolished to make room for the floodplain Amanda and I are looking at right now. Floodplains like this one let water spread out during a heavy rain event, dissipating the energy that rips through homes and causes destruction. It's the sort of project scientists say could really help some Vermont communities lower floodwaters when they come. But then, in July of 2023, the floodwaters did come.
This area flooded again very, very badly, and then flooded actually possibly a touch worse in July of 2024.
In spite of all the work the town had done to reestablish this natural floodplain, it didn't do enough.
There are houses up and down and around this area that got hit very, very badly in both of those floods,
In fact, several other homeowners in this neighborhood have applied for buyouts, which would expand the floodplain even more. But buyouts also present challenges. There are questions about where people go next, about how to pay for them, and about how they can affect a city's budget. Amanda says this case, it's an example of the messy process of adapting to climate change. And there's where that building the plane while flying it metaphor comes in again. Adapting to what the future holds and addressing the root cause of the problem at the same time, it's a tall task.
We're in one of those moments where we have to do both and. And that feels huge. That feels really hard. And that is a huge sink of resources, not just, you know, people say resources, they time, money, stuff. It's also a huge sink of willpower, of people being willing to knuckle down and do slow, difficult work for a long time. It took us a long time to get here. It's going to take a long time to get out. Of course things are going to fail. Of course we're going to do the wrong thing. That's what learning is about. It stinks. it really hurts when a thing that you thought was going to be the answer is only part of the answer. The enormous pressure, and I think what a lot of people feel, that enormous pressure to, like, we have to get it right. We're at a crisis point. Yes. And also, like, some of it we're not going to get right. We have to keep doing better. And if you just say, if this fails, that's it, then you're giving up on the whole potential of other things that might work. You have to move forward.
The floodplain Amanda showed me in Barrie is in transition between past and present. Not quite what it was, but not yet quite what it needs to be, which I think is a good way to describe this moment for Vermont as a whole. If I can offer one prediction, Vermonters will be focused on this for a long time. Long after the Affordable Heat Act gets fully hashed out or not. Long after the next flood and the ones after that. Long after this election cycle and many more to come.
Thanks for listening to the show, and thanks to Laura Zettler of Fairfax and Pam Lads of Newport for sharing their curiosity with us. If you want to learn more about the Affordable Heat Act or any other Vermont climate policies, and to find out more about where specific candidates stand on climate issues, we added some links in the show notes. Also, our amazing team at Vermont Public published individual voter guides for a lot of major issues, like taxes, housing, and healthcare. I found them really helpful, personally. If you want to check them out, they're all at vermontpublic.org. And of course, if you have a question about Vermont you want Brave Little State to answer, or to vote for the topic of an upcoming episode, you can do it all at bravelittlestate.org. This episode was reported by Abigail Giles. It was produced and edited by me, Josh Crane, with help from Sabine Pooks, Burgess Brown, Brittany Patterson, and Sophie Stevens. Angela Evansy is Brave Little State's executive producer. Our theme music is by Ty Gibbons, other music by Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Mark Davis, Rachel Cletus, Terry Callahan, Jennifer Durgan, Tony Epperl, Donna Smyers, Joanna Nichols, Jennifer Francoeur, and Janelle Ron. We'll be back soon with more people-powered Vermont journalism.